A few years ago, you would have found Ita Segev in the Israeli army, training to patrol the West Bank. Today,
hello there! This is your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother speaking.
Ita is a trans-feminine performance artist and an anti-Zionist activist. In December of 2017, she debuted a one-person show in a small theater in New York City. In the show, she stands hunched over and barefoot in the middle of the stage in all gold. Golden short-sleeved shirt, golden patterned skirt, and golden hoop earrings. She has long red nails. In the character of an imagined grandmother from many generations back, she explains that she has something for Ita, which has been passed down from each generation. It's a gift, a little seed.
Which is the seed of your transsexualism? It is yours. It always has been and it always will be. But there is a catch.
The catch, says Ita's great-great-great-great-great-grandmother, has to do with the place where Ita was born.
I hid the seed inside a forest near Jerusalem. And it is a forest of deception. And you will have to uncover all of the lies told to you about who you are and where you're from in order to find that seed. So, best of luck to you, eh?
Today, we venture into that forest of deception. We hear how Ita uncovered not only her trans identity, but also how she found her position as an anti-Zionist. For Ita, these two concepts of Zionism and gender, they're not just related, they're inseparable. I'm Yoshi Fields, and this is Unsettled. Ita Segev didn't always feel like an outsider. She grew up in Jerusalem, in a middle-class Ashkenazi family. They were secular and liberal Zionists. As a child, she was told she was a boy and believed it.
I don't have the tropes of, like, when I was four, I wore my mother's dresses. Mm-hmm. Like, something never fit, but the fact that I didn't have a name for it made it, in some ways, not exist. There was, like, enough wiggle room that it wasn't, like, pressing.
Ita also felt at home in Israel.
You're told that this is yours, that you belong here. Your name that you're given is Israeli. Zionism is very good at, like, connecting itself to the land. So you go on all these field trips and you walk the land and you're sort of taught that this is, like, inherently yours. And not only that it is yours, you develop, obviously, like, an intense emotional connection.
She had a particularly strong connection to a forest near Jerusalem, which had been named after her grandparents.
My mom talks a lot about the sort of light that exists in that forest because the trees, like, play this game where the sun kind of really peeks between them in this really beautiful way. We would just go out sometimes with friends if it was, like, my birthday or an event, and sometimes with family and just, like, hang out there all day, you know, and eat picnics. And, like, there were bees and it was, like, an event of how to hide the food from the bees. And, like, there would always be the one cousin who's, like, afraid of the bees. And there's something as a kid to the fact that you're, like, on the one hand in nature, but I got to brag and be like, come to this forest, it's my grandpa's forest.
She never thought of her home or any of the land claimed by Israel in its independence war as anything but Israel. She was told it had been a land without a people for a people without a land, or that the Arabs did not want Jews there and started a war that Jews won.
Growing up in Israel, Palestine, but learning that there's no such thing as Palestine. It's there all the time, but it's also invisible.
There were some Israeli policies she didn't agree with, and she wasn't afraid of expressing it.
I went to, like, synagogue in, like, Yom Kippur with, like, a Che Guevara t-shirt when I was, like, seven, you know. I was, like, the youngest member of the political movement, which is, like, the farthest left still within a Zionist context, Meretz. And so, like, a larger politics in which you, like, call out things that are invisibilized became this thing that I really was drawn to.
But by 12 years old, expectations of how a boy should act became more defined. Ita suddenly didn't fit in with her peers. Where her smarts had once protected her in school, suddenly boys were throwing punches.
You sort of had to be prepared to fight all the time, and I would just, like, freeze. So, like, someone would slap me, and I, like, didn't know how to protect myself, and that was, like, such a source of shame.
Around this time, Ita joined the Sofim, which is similar to the Boy and Girl Scouts in the U.S. There, she got a nickname that would last until she was 18. Not gay or a girl, the ones you might expect from kids in middle school.
My nickname became like Holocaust Boy. A certain kind of femininity is read as weakness, is read as like a foreign Jew that is not capable essentially of defending themselves, right? That is sort of the legacy of the diss of like folks and the Holocaust.
And it was soon after joining the Scouts that Ita went to an army base for the first time. And she had a realization.
One day I'll have to go to the army, because if not, they'll find out I'm blank. I didn't have a word. Like, they'll find out this thing about me that others me, and like I won't belong to the society anymore.
Without the language to know exactly what this blank was, she began to secretly think she was gay.
When I was like, oh my God, I might be a faggot, and was like, but they want me to be this kind of man, I was like, I need to hide my politics and my gender.
Once you started to feel like, oh, I am really different, like there's something about me that's different.
Yeah.
Then you're like, oh, I have to pretend I'm not.
Yes.
Suddenly.
Yes. Yes. Super aggressively. I started like wearing my pants a certain way and walking a certain way and talking. I think still the voice you're hearing me talk now is like me confronting years of me like lowering my voice in order to pass a certain way. The biggest honor was like to read the memorial, both for like the Holocaust Memorial Service and for the memorial service for soldiers. And the people who usually did it had like these, you know, and I like worked in order to be the person who would do that.
And in the Scouts, there was no shortage of opportunities to prove your manliness.
They would do these literally like sort of masculinization ceremonies in which they would put boiling hot water in your mouth and like put a tea bag in it and make tea in your mouth. And you just like had to stay like that.
That was for an initiation ceremony to the next rank. She was rewarded for her particularly impressive ability to withstand pain. At the same time, Ita felt a strong disconnect with her own body.
So I was able to like endure a lot of like excruciating weights and pain and suffering in a way that then under Zionism was like celebrated as masculinity. Like, wow, you know, that person is like skinny, but look how fast they can crawl and they don't care that their elbows are bleeding. And that became like this weird point of pride almost.
Ita had transformed herself in an attempt to prove she could be a strong Israeli man, and she was being rewarded for it. But she was struggling to keep up the facade. In Israel, military service is required after high school, and even as early as 14, in her group of scouts.
There becomes a lot of pressure of like who's going to go to the most elite unit and the most combat training. And there was this pride around the fact that we had the most soldiers that died out of all of the country. And there were 49 soldiers who died, and there was a joke going around about like who would be the 50th, but like who would get to be the 50th. And it was almost like this joke that like you actually kind of wanted it. You
know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, this is intense, but it's a pretty common phenomenon for trans folks. But I was never, like, thought of harming myself or was suicidal, but I also couldn't imagine growing up. I didn't have a sense of what it would be like. I knew I was putting all of my energy to become this thing that I was not, and I think I was like, at some point I'm just going to run out of energy, but I don't know if there'll... I couldn't imagine an alternative yet. And so I had a lot of like these deep fantasies of like, it would be kind of excellent if I die, like at least I'll die in the army, you know, and I'll be a hero and everybody will remember me and everybody will cry about me. Because like the army and the Holocaust are these two events that function as permission to mourn. That's sort of the only permission in like masculine Zionism that you really get to feel your feelings.
Around this time, Ito went on a school trip to Har Herzl, a large national burial ground for soldiers, which is right across from Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum.
Like a whole mountain dedicated to memory.
Ita had been trying so hard to hide part of who she was, trying her best to be the powerful, non-emotive man. And as she stood at the burial ground, she saw this little moment where she thought it would be acceptable to cry.
And I kind of fell apart. I like literally don't know what to do. Like I don't know how to keep living like this under these rules. And everyone like looked at me like, what the fuck is wrong? And then someone came up to me and was like, why are you weeping? And the thing that came out is like, my cousin died in the army.
But this wasn't actually true. Ita had just made the cousin up.
Like as an excuse, or like that's sort of the only time it's really okay to be really sad.
By the time she turned 18 and it was time for her to actually go to the army, she no longer had the fantasy of dying in the line of duty. In fact, she felt torn. Though she had long since given up on expressing her leftist views, she still felt sympathetic to Palestinians. But the same clarity she had felt the first time she went to the army base as a child, she felt now. She had no choice but to serve. And not only that, she was set on getting rid of whatever was making her different, once and for all.
If I don't go to the army, people will know I'm queer. And so in order to like prove to myself that I'm not, like that was my last attempt to kill the thing. And I think I was telling this like sort of Zionist leftist narrative of like, if I'm there, I'll be nicer to them than someone else. Like if I don't go, these settlers would go and I'll give candy to the kids. I don't know what I was expecting, but that was the fantasy.
As you might imagine, the reality was a bit different. Ita was drafted into a combat unit that polices the West Bank.
It was a lot of things. I mean, it was terrible. It was also in some capacity thrilling. I still carry the knowledge of like how much past the point I think I can go anymore, I can actually go. Just now, like, I don't romanticize it. I think it's a stupid exercise. But there is, like, you can get off on that. Mm-hmm. And I was good at it, you know, and I was, like, becoming hotter or, like, more attractive in the fantasy of masculinity is.
For the second time in her life, first in the Scouts and now in the Army, she was congratulated for her ability to withstand pain. Unlike her old nickname, Holocaust Boy, which referred to those who did not fight and suffered and died. Here, she was celebrated for being the opposite, a man who was so tough that he would not stop no matter the pain. And Ita was actually in more pain than most people could see.
The only thing I knew about myself is that, like, you know, I'm with 40 naked guys a bunch of times a day in the shower and I, like, want all of them to be in my mouth, but I didn't have any sense of, like, my gender yet. And I had a girlfriend at the time, and I would go home from the army, and there's like this narrative of coming home and going to your girlfriend and eating meat and fucking her. But I would like go home and like go to sleep with sweatpants and like 7 layers, even though it was the dead of summer, so she wouldn't really touch me.
Her girlfriend broke up with her, and soon after,
I started developing this sort of intense physical pain because of the training. And weirdly or not, the pain was like right in the perineum, which is like right between the anus and front genitalia, right in the middle. Which today I can psychologize what my body was screaming. But that pain was very intense.
Eventually, the army gave her medical leave to recover. On her way home, she stopped with her unit at an army base in Bethlehem in the West Bank. It was the first active base her unit had been to since training had started.
We got there, and the fear of the unit was that there won't be enough action.
Ita explained that in the army, not seeing action is the biggest disappointment.
Because then you're like, why did I go through all of this? Right. If it's almost like a video game, if I don't actually get to practice it.
But about 10 minutes after they got to the army base,
a few soldiers came in with a Palestinian prisoner, a young, what seemed to be then as a young man. Their eyes were like covered in like sort of a piece of cloth so they couldn't see. And their hands were tied behind their back so they couldn't really move their hands. And there was an attack dog, which was the attack dog of the unit, that was like repeatedly biting this prisoner's leg. And while this was happening repeatedly, the entire unit was so happy that us newbies are seeing the action that they all started clapping hands in synchronicity. So there was like this synchronized clapping, almost like a Jewish wedding, but in the middle there was like this bleeding Palestinian whose like leg is being chewed on. You know, I know I didn't stop it. I know I didn't say anything. I don't remember myself in the situation.
Still in shock, a few days later, Ita went home as planned to recuperate from the physical pain she had been experiencing.
And while I was in recovery...
Good evening. We are 11 days into the first war of the new year. It has so far killed over 600 people.
We're faced with a very, very tough enemy here, and we have to take action.
In fact, Hamas has fired more than 6,000 rockets.
Unbelievable, the amount of damage that has been caused over the past 5 days by Israel's relentless attacks on the civilian population.
Israel called the attack on Gaza Operation Cast Lead, and it lasted from December of 2008 into January of 2009.
And everyone in my unit besides me went in. As I was like watching all my friends, I was like, there is something really sick here. There's like a twisted fetish of war in this place that they'll just keep doing this and doing this. And my impulse was like, I need to leave. So that like injury essentially saved my life, I think, on many levels.
But it wasn't that simple. She still had to finish her 3 years of service. She was able to get transferred to another unit, this time not as a combat soldier, but as a military journalist. She loved to write, and so she thought it was a great idea.
I remember going to interview soldiers and their parents in like the day of drafting. What I was supposed to do is make it like a festive day. And I would interview these moms, like who are with their usually then sons about to go on the bus and become soldiers. And so many of the moms would repeat this narrative of like, his grandfather went to that unit, his father went to that unit, he's going to that unit, and like one day his son and grandson will go to that unit. And that was really a point where I was like, why are you wishing your grandson this? Like, it's one thing to say we needed this far, but I hope that by the time my grandson comes here, we don't need it anymore. But this, like, was another, like, fetish of war.
After these experiences, she no longer dreamt of being the ideal Israeli man. And once she gave that up, things started to change pretty fast. Instead of trying to kill her attraction to guys, she started to explore it. She went to therapy, came out as gay, and began dating men. It was liberating, but there was still a lot she wasn't confronting.
I sort of was so preoccupied by my own queerness that I used it as like a shield or defense block to like actually confront the extent of the harm that my other identities were like causing others.
She didn't confront the ways her ethnicity, race, and nationality were being used to, as she would later see it, oppress others. Facing this would later prove pivotal to understanding her queerness. But it didn't seem that way at the time. Instead, in search of a fresh start, as soon as she finished her army service, she made another big decision.
I'm moving to New York. And I like fell in love with a man so deeply in a relationship that lasted like 6 years and wow. sort of was huge, and was like, I'm forgetting about that part of my life. Hmm. I didn't like when people asked me where I'm from. I remember writing like a poem in an open mics, like that started like, sometimes where you're from tells a lot about who you're not, you know? I was 22. I think I was also super into the falling in love and like did the feminine thing where like I figured out my desire for a man, but then substituted that as like a definition of myself.
What was originally supposed to only be a summer in New York became years. She went to acting school, got into the party scene. She was having fun. But then?
This has been the bloodiest day yet in the fighting in Gaza between Israel and Hamas.
You can hear the tanks shelling in the distance. You can see black smoke coming up in plumes out of Gaza City. All evidence of an intensified ground operation.
While playing soccer on the beach, four Palestinian boys were killed and several others wounded by what witnesses described as artillery shells from a nearby Navy ship.
In the summer of 2014, Israel once again invaded Gaza in what they called Operation Protective Edge.
I remember feeling in my guts this feeling of like, there are people in Gaza right now who are being bombarded by planes and they can't leave. And I think every Jewish person and every queer person knows intuitively what it would mean if you weren't able to leave when you needed to leave. Right, we would not be here.
Ita saw that this ability to leave when you need to, something she had just done a few years before, was a right these Palestinians did not have.
And that like kind of shook me. Okay, I need to do something about this.
After years of focusing almost solely on her queer identity, she began to look at her Israeli one. As she learned more about Israel, Ita went back through her own family's history and saw it in a new light. Memories that had been repressed from years ago began to come up.
My grandmother, who I was like extremely close to, was like a European refugee. Her mother heard Hitler's acceptance speech and was like, that's an evil man, and like decided to leave that day.
Ita's grandmother and her family fled to Latin America, where she married and then lived in El Salvador. But when a civil war broke out, they fled once again, this time to Israel.
My grandfather became the ambassador of El Salvador to Israel. They kind of moved from being like these really poor refugees to like these like upper middle class white Latin people who were coming as ambassadors. And so that was sort of the narrative we grew up with, one of running away, escaping, knowing when it's time to leave and rebuilding yourself.
After living in the embassy as ambassadors, her grandparents moved to another house.
The domes were like beautiful. There was like an olive tree in the backyard. And we would say it's an Arab house, but really we were like referring to architecture and not to like human beings. I would go to my grandmother's house once or twice a week. And like I would get there. She still had this Latin America thing of like having a siesta. I would go unplug her like her phone so she could sleep. She would tell me I'm a nice Jewish boy. I didn't know to say I'm not a boy yet. We left that. Then she would like wake up. We would like watch The Bold and the Beautiful together, like a telenovela. And then one day when we were doing this ritual, the door rang to her home and she went to open the door. And I was there with her and this old Palestinian woman was standing in the front door. And she told my grandmother that this used to be her family's house and that they used to live there and that she hasn't been back since. And my grandmother told her that it's not a good time right now and sort of like didn't allow, she asked to come in and my grandmother closed the door and didn't allow her to come into her home. And I was like a kid and I saw this happen, you know, and obviously my grandma did the same thing of going to her house in Germany and knocking on the door and seeing it. I go back to that story or that moment a lot and I try lovingly but like critically to understand how someone like her didn't let another grandmother come in. And I think she just like couldn't fathom the dissonance. Like she could not emotionally or psychologically fathom the fact that she is now in that position of someone else. And so,
like, she's still trapped in the narrative of being the oppressed.
Yeah, or even if she's past the narrative of being the oppressed, it's like a very long journey between being the oppressed and like being that level of the oppressor. They moved in a single generation between being like slaughtered and refugees to being like colonialists.
Right. It's wild.
It's wild.
Yeah.
And she couldn't fathom it.
Like with the memory of her grandmother, Ita reflected on many other childhood memories. Formerly happy, they now felt tainted. Like the forest, which was named after her grandparents in Israel, where she'd had so many fond memories of birthdays and connecting with her grandfather.
No one teaches you that, like, that forest was planted there over the ruins of Palestinian village, and that it was purposely given to Jews like us, white Jews, to name after their dead relatives, exactly so we feel that feeling.
And more than just seeing how Zionism had tried to erase the plight of Palestinians, from speaking with Arab Jews, she realized how narrow her understanding of Judaism had been. As a kid, she only knew about Ashkenazi culture.
I didn't have any understanding of, like, my place in the world. It's not a mistake that all your parents' professor friends are all Ashkenazi, or a lot of your teachers teaching you history are teaching you, like, Ashkenazi history. Israeli identity, whatever the fuck that means, is very good at, like, erasing difference, even within Jewish society. A lot of Arab Jews are taught, and maybe I shouldn't, you know, we should be speaking to an Arab Jew about this, but I feel like I have insight, but are taught very aggressively to, like, erase their Arabness and, like, assimilate into Europeanness in order to belong to this thing that under Zionism is called Judaism, but is actually white Judaism.
As she learned more, for the first time in her life, she began to question her support of Zionism altogether. All of the injustices that she was seeing seemed to connect back to the very foundation of Zionism itself.
A bunch of, like, wealthy white Jews sitting in England with, like, wealthy white non-Jews and, like, deciding the fate of a place that they do not live in. Some of them have never even been to. With other people who currently control the place who are not from there and never been there. And so I think it's inherently a very white strategy.
I asked her, wasn't Zionism more about the survival of Jews? Israel was founded just a few years after the Holocaust ended. But Ita said, the Zionist movement started years before the Holocaust, and it was based on British settler colonialism. It was, at least in part, about the erasure of Palestinians who were living there from the very beginning.
The Middle East and Israel-Palestine is an Arab place in which we, the European Jews, are guests. It's up to us to behave like that. It's up to us to adjust. It's up to us to, like, shut up and listen and unlearn and learn. Zionism is a white Jewish problem.
And as Ita was coming to new understandings about her relationship to Zionism, another part of her identity was emerging.
Really strangely, as that was happening, that somehow, like, created also a space for my, like, gender to start expressing itself. I don't know which happened first, but they happened, like, very simultaneously. It felt like I was carrying all this weight of these ideas and expectations and stories that were not mine, but I was told were mine and who I am. And as I started, like, excavating them and, like, putting them on the ground, this, like, space was created for, like, what is mine to, like, flow more clearly or naturally.
And so Ita found herself in an unexpected situation.
I'm, like, weirdly gonna come out as, like, trans and anti-Zionist at the same time.
She knew this double coming out was not going to be easy.
that required sort of a second wave of like being ready, because I was like, okay, there's going to be repercussions to this one. This will mean the relationship that I stayed in New York for, where I fell in love, will probably like fall apart. This will mean that I'll have very difficult conversations with my family. There were a lot of people that I lost. And there was a lot of access to stuff that I lost. And a lot of access to stuff that I'm still losing.
It's been a little over a year since she came out to her family. Talking about her gender with them has actually turned out to be easier than talking about her views on Zionism.
They'll find all these ways to talk to me about anything but the content of my work.
Like her performance art, which you heard at the beginning of the episode.
They'll see a video of the performance and they'll say they like the costumes or the lighting or that I'm funny. But they'll never actually engage with me in the things I want to talk about completely. I literally think that I go and speak on the radio and stand in front of a bunch of strangers and have the conversations I wish I could have with my family but didn't have. It's like, let's have the family dinner where we actually say what we think and talk about everything and see how this goes. There's a tremendous but necessary heartbreak that happens when you face the huge gaps, really like enormous gaps between the narratives we were told about Israel and Palestine and Zionism and actual reality. I feel like in some ways for the first time in my life I'm like standing on my own like 2 feet, because I know the truth about where I'm from. I don't no longer have that defensive mechanism that when people talk about Zionism or Israel, I feel like they're attacking me at all. I'm like, you're right.
But Ita's story doesn't end with her self-discovery or her newfound confidence in searching for truth, even when it's hard to look. About 10 months ago, she decided to begin her medical transition. She imagined,
I'll go to like the pharmacy and I'll get my estrogen and like I'll put the pill under my tongue and it will sort of wash away all the like toxic masculinity inside of me. That will sort of like this rebirth fantasy.
But when she went to the pharmacy, she looked at her pill bottle and saw,
made by Teva. And Teva is like one of the largest pharmaceutical Israeli companies.
Ita is a supporter of BDS, which is a movement that works to end Israel's oppression of Palestinians by internationally boycotting the state of Israel.
And I'm like, wait, I can't be taking hormones that are made by an Israeli company. So I ask what other companies make hormones in my pharmacy, and I'm told that none are. And so like I text one trans girlfriend and I'm like, hey, who makes your hormones? And she's like, Teva. And then I text another one and I'm like, who makes your hormones? And she's like, Teva. And then I text another one and she's like, who makes your hormones? And she says some other company. And I'm like, amazing. And I Google it and it's a company owned by Teva. They're really forcing us to make this liberating moment for ourselves on someone else.
Ita has teamed up with Darren Copeland, a student at Mills College, who's been doing research on how Teva came to have a monopoly on cross-gender hormones. Darren and Ita found that
in the late 60s, when the state of Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza, the state of Israel was in charge of taking care of Palestinian health care, which it never did.
Instead, Israel suppressed potential growth of the Palestinian pharmaceutical industry and limited Palestinian access to medication. At the same time, the government made policies that greatly benefited Israeli pharmaceutical companies. Based on their findings, Ita concluded,
so essentially, Teva became this huge company that started buying other companies directly because of the oppression of Palestinians.
Ita and Darren are currently looking for alternative companies to Teva.
Have you decided to take the estrogen? Or no?
Oh, yeah.
You have?
Yeah. I mean, this was like, I found this out like when I took my first prescription. I don't completely see it as a decision, but I took the estrogen because that's what I needed to do.
Before my conversation with Ita ended, I asked her.
Lots of people said anti-Zionists are self-hating Jews. And what do you say to this?
I love the good self-hating Jew moment. It's really confusing to me when people people don't know the difference between love and hate. I'm still insisting on the fact that we can retain our humanity and dignity and respect to other people as Jews, and I have no idea what that has to do with self-hate. I know what self-hate is. I've experienced that for years, and that's not what my anti-Zionism feels like at all. In unified Palestine or Israel-Palestine or whatever it will be called, if and I want to say when that day happens, that's I think what keeps me going. The belief or the hope of one day existing in where I'm from without the feeling that it's on someone else's expense all the time. And, you know, of course, I imagine that the moment that happens, there's just all these gorgeous trans women and drag queens just parading the street and welcoming me, which might be a fantasy. But I definitely do think that the downfall of Zionism will also be the downfall of an aggressive masculinity that comes with it. And so I think also just as I've never been back since I transitioned, I don't know what that's like. But I don't. Yeah, I would. Ugh, there's nothing I would love more. There's nothing I would love more.
In a recent essay, Ita writes, "As opposed to a Zionist state on stolen Palestinian land, my transness is in fact my birthright. The fierceness of letting go of what isn't mine opened the space for reclaiming what is." Ita currently lives in New York City and is an artist council member of Jewish Voice for Peace. She's continuing to develop her first evening-length show, which you heard a bit from at the very beginning, Not in My Name. It's hard to transition when you're escaping something. As an act of solidarity with the Palestinians' call for BDS, she and Darren Copeland recently started T4 Palestine, an open online source for medicalized trans folks to find hormones produced outside of Israel. Darren is also finishing up his thesis, Israel's Pharmaceutical Industry and the Political Economy of Hormone Replacement Therapy. You can find writing about their project and Ita's personal essays on Condé Nast's Them publication. You can also follow her on Instagram at ItaQT, that's I-T-A-Q-T. Links to Ita's essays and more information on the Israeli government's effects on Palestinian healthcare are also on our website, unsettledpod.com. We reached out to both the IDF and the Tzofim, the Israeli scouts, and neither organization would comment. However, there have been reports of hazing in the scouts that are similar to Ita's experience. And we also found many reports of IDF dogs biting Palestinians. Unsettled is produced by Emily Bell, Asaf Calderon, Yoshi Fields, Max Friedman, and Alana Levinson. This episode was edited by me, Yoshi Fields. Special thanks to Max Friedman for help with scoring and to Joel Shupak, Pola Lem, and Sam Anderson for editorial guidance. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. Original Unsettled theme music by Nat Rosenzweig. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And most importantly, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode of Unsettled.